Please turn to the book of Daniel. I warned you last time that we would be looking at Daniel this time, because if you're going to talk about beasts in Revelation, you really have to talk about beasts in Daniel. Okay. I also reprinted the Zechariah one-pager. Here's a Daniel one-pager. I got enough, I think. All right. So, a couple weeks ago, we talked about doing this kind of exercise. I'll run through it really quickly, because I know at least the Doyles were not here. So, one thing you can do when you're reading, this is just a simple outlining exercise that you can go through. We did it with Zechariah 2 weeks ago. I'll talk about this Daniel one right now. Is read through the book one time, just straight through it. Not really, you know, spending any extra time on much of anything. And then read through it again and start outlining. And start looking at, okay, how do chapters group together? How do paragraphs group together? If you look at Zechariah, there's a whole lot more breakdown in Zechariah than there is in Daniel, at least a little bit more. Because he has smaller visions. But Daniel breaks down actually really well into chapters until you get to the very end. At the very end it breaks down. And I mean break down in that sense in a different way. English. At that point, you really got the last unit, chapters 10, 11, and 12, are one long vision. All right, and so you go through and you read it again, except this time you read it more slowly, and you start trying to see how it organizes itself. All right. If we looked at Zechariah, if you turn that over and glance at that, it very clearly broke into two big divisions. And Daniel actually does the same, and I didn't really bring it out very well in the outline. In Zechariah, the first half is about visions. And so it's of a very different character than the second half, where the second half is about prophecies. Visions, there's more images there. There's more confusing symbols. And then the latter part is a lot more straightforward, actually, in Zechariah. In Daniel, the general breakdown is 1 through 6 is somebody else's visions, and 7 on is Daniel's visions. And so the first few, let's look at them real quick. Well, wait a second, then we'll look at it. And so that's generally how it breaks down. So you break down the book, you start grouping things, you see how it's organized, and then what I've got on the right-hand side in square brackets is I force myself to pick one verse. And I really do limit it to just one verse, even if it doesn't work very well. Just to say, what is the most representative verse in this chapter? What can I pick that will, if I just read this one verse, I'll get the most of the idea from this chapter. And then at the bottom, I just put some highlights. Okay. So if we look at Daniel, why don't you start at the beginning of the book with me, and we'll just run through it. And then we're going to focus more on the end of the book. Daniel chapter 1, if you wanted to, you could break out the first few verses into its own separate subsection where it talks about him getting to Babylon. Now, it starts with that, and then it goes into a story about Daniel's faithfulness. And I'm sure we know probably all of these stories, all right? The first story is Daniel is in captivity, and they're trying to feed him all sorts of rich, kingly food, all right, to fatten him up and to make him healthier. But David and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or Belteshazzar is his Babylonian name. All right, they say, nope, we don't want to do that. Just give us vegetables. We're going to drink your rich wine and see how we do. Think of Daniel, especially this first half of the book, as like an instruction manual for what happens when you're not in control. You are in a foreign land, not really able to live the way that you want to live. All right? Because this is what they're dealing with, right? They are taken from their home, and they are brought into Babylon, and Daniel has to figure out, how do I live a godly life when I have been taken into captivity? And so that's what these stories. The first one establishes, what do the four Jewish boys, what do? Well, they're going to try to be faithful to God. They're going to try to follow the law. All right? They're not going to be, well, that's the... in the future, they won't be idolaters and things like that. So that's the first story. He's going to be faithful to his God. The second story is the story of Nebuchadnezzar having a dream. And this is the dream of Nebuchadnezzar seeing a statue. Golden head, all right? And you got head, torso, legs, feet. And the feet are mixed with iron and clay. And then a stone comes and hits the feet, and the whole thing is destroyed, and the stone grows into a mountain. And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and Daniel reveals the dream and the interpretation to Nebuchadnezzar, saying, hey, these are kingdoms. You're the golden head. All right? That's you. You're the first. And the others are a succession of kingdoms. And that is the first of several chapters that are all based around discussions of successions of kingdoms. All right, the general breakdown probably being, and there's debate about it, the general breakdown being Babylonians, Medo-Persian Empire, Alexander the Great, and the Greeks after him as one, and then the Romans. And so one of the big stories there, all right, one of the big things that's shown there is the big point, and this is a major point throughout the rest of the book, that God reveals to Daniel. All right? And in the general flow of, here you have these Jewish boys in the foreign nation, you know what? God went with them, as we've already discussed with Ezekiel, right? God went with them, and he's with Daniel. And when Daniel needs help, God's there to help him, even in this captivity. Chapter 3. And if you look at the names, in the first story, it's Nebuchadnezzar. In the second story, it's Nebuchadnezzar. In the third story, it's once again Nebuchadnezzar. This is where Nebuchadnezzar creates basically a really large image, and people have to worship that image. But now the other three Jewish friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refuse to do that, and so they are thrown into the fiery furnace. We know this story. They are thrown into the fiery furnace. They say, you know, Nebuchadnezzar says, your God can't save you. And they say, our God can. He may not, but he can if he wants to. And so they are thrown into the furnace. God does save them, all right? And the output of that is, you know, if we look at 3:28, Nebuchadnezzar answered, this is after they were brought out of the furnace alive. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. All right? And so therefore, what's the message for the exiles? Be willing to give up your own body, your own life. What you do is you remain faithful to the law. You remain faithful to the covenant. That's the message for them. Chapter 4, you've got Nebuchadnezzar having a dream about a tree, a very large tree. All right, there's like animals hanging out under the tree, there's birds in the tree, there's fruit in the tree, it's a super great tree. But then the tree is cut down, all right? And so the tree is cut down, and it's kind of bound, but then things are okay after that. And so Nebuchadnezzar's like, what does this mean? He's troubled by this. No one can ever interpret these visions except for Daniel. So once again, we come back to Daniel, who's the interpreter of dreams. And Daniel comes back to him and he says, you're the tree. You're huge and prosperous and powerful. But God's going to cut you down for your pride. And for a time, you're going to be humbled. All right? But then you will be restored. When you repent. And so what happens about a year later, Nebuchadnezzar standing on the roof of his palace looking at Babylon. This is Nebuchadnezzar. Looking at Babylon and going, man, look at all this stuff that I by my own power have built. And then God judges him, makes him go crazy, chops him down in the image. And he is essentially insane for a period of time, where he walks around on all fours. He lives out in the wild until God returns him to his sanity. Chapter 5, we've got a different ruler. Chapter 5, verse 1, you see King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. It's probably this time where we should think about our timeline. Let's go ahead and start putting some things on there. Okay. Oops. Okay. Elliot, what year did Assyria take the northern kingdom?
587.
Nope. 722. Northern kingdom. What happened to 587, though?
Something with Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Babylon takes the southern kingdom. If we take our... If we call this zero, all right? There is no zero. If we call this 1 BC, all right? And so this is going to be 350-ish. And so 587 is going to be here. Okay, so 587... This is Babylon, all right? Babylon is the major power at that point. 722 is Assyria. Okay. You've got, if you look at the top of your Daniel thing, you'll see some more pieces. You've got at 539, okay, Cyrus the Great, so-called Cyrus the Great. What did Cyrus do? Conquered Babylon, and then he is the one who allowed the Jews to go back to their land. Now, okay, we'll stick with that for right now. Belshazzar, all right, Belshazzar is in this time frame. This is right before the Persians come in and whip up on the Babylonians. So what happens with Belshazzar is, you know, when Daniel's taken into exile... All right, it's actually more like here. It's before the final, we discussed this, like Ezekiel. It's before the final destruction of Jerusalem. Daniel's taken into captivity. And so he's here and then living at least this far, so far, right? And so they've got, at this point, they have the booty from the temple in Jerusalem. All right, they've had it for quite some time. Belshazzar says, hey, I'm having a party. Let's take the dishes from the temple, the gold and silver, and let's use them as drinking cups and our party. And this is where there is the handwriting is on the wall, all right? This is where, when they do that, God basically, it's not a vision in this case. This is God writes on the wall and says that even though they can't read it, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to destroy you. And so they are... Belshazzar is freaked out because his writing appears on the wall, so he calls Daniel. Daniel comes in and basically says, because you're disrespecting God, God is going to destroy you. And then shortly after that, God did in fact destroy them with Cyrus the Great. So that's Belshazzar. All right, so let's look at the next chapter. Chapter 6. Now this one is not a vision. A lot of these others have to do with visions. This one is not. This is Darius. All right. This is when Darius is set over the kingdom. Now, there's some discussion on who this is. After Cyrus the Great dies, there is a Cyrus on this side. Excuse me, a Darius on this side. A great king Darius. It could be that Darius. There's also someone called Darius the Mede, which shows up in later chapters. It could be just a different Darius who is put in charge over Babylon. It's unclear. But this one could definitely be the big Darius because he is putting satraps throughout the whole kingdom. So you've got Daniel here where basically the pagan guys in Darius's court are like, hey, we hate Daniel. We want that guy dead. Because he's at this point, Daniel, if this is that Darius, as it probably is, if it is that Darius, well, Daniel is super old at this point. I mean, really old. but also very well respected. And so they want him dead, but they can't find a reason to kill him because he's always good. All right, it's a problem. So what do? They go to the king and say, hey, for a period of time, make a law where if anyone prays to anyone but you, you kill them. You throw them in the lion's den. And the king's like, yeah, this is a great idea. Let's do it. And so he signs it into a law. But he really likes Daniel, as it turns out. And they know that. And so therefore, this gets signed into a law. They see Daniel in his window praying towards Jerusalem. And so they like, ha, we got him. They go to the king and say, Daniel's doing this. And the king's like, I don't want to kill Daniel. And they're like, it's in the law. You yourself wrote it. And so Darius tells him, I'm sorry, I hope your God protects you. But he throws him into the lion's den. And as you know, Daniel survives. When Daniel gets out, the king is like, I'm really glad that you lived. Now I'm going to throw all those people who talked me into making this law into the lion's den, and then they're dead. And so, eaten by lions. And so, you know, the story is similar to what we've seen. These Hebrews who are taken into Babylon, they are faithful, all right? They're sticking with the law. They are not bowing to idols. It would be very normal in that world to look at the Persian king and go, you're a god, and that's exactly what they would often expect. That doesn't fit with Jewish theology at all. And so the Jews are like, no. And so Daniel and his friends are faithful in that context. Starting in chapter 7, you've got Belshazzar, once again. And this is the story of four beasts. All right, this is a vision that Daniel has. And after this point, this is more about God revealing straight to Daniel about things about the future. And it's really at this point where we have major overlap with language and ideas that you're going to find in Revelation. So if we really look real quick at Daniel chapter 7, verse 2, I saw in my vision by night, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. That's where one of the beasts will come from in Revelation. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then it looked, and I looked, and its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and the mind of a man was given to it. So, I'll keep going. Behold, another beast, the second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had three ribs in his mouth between its teeth, and it was told, arise, devour much flesh. After that I looked, behold, there was another like a leopard with four wings on the of a bird on its back, and the beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. And after this I saw in the night vision, behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong, so the worst beast of all. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. All right? So four beasts. What you get in the interpretation is you get, ultimately, you get, these are various kingdoms. Also in this chapter, all right, because after these kingdoms comes the reign of the saints of God. This is where you have the Ancient of Days. This is where you have the Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days and receiving all dominion. In this chapter, in chapter 7, what you've got is you've got ultimately four kingdoms. Now, the majority opinion on this, and I think this is the right one, and this seems to be what the author of Revelation is doing, is he's going to treat these as four separate kingdoms, being, here's one, the kingdom of Babylon. All right, this is actually similar to the statue thing. All right, and somebody, when did Alexander the Great do his conquest? 323. That is when he actually died. All right, also important date. So that's going to be, let's call this Alexander. I think it was 336. Is that right, when he started? So Alexander, okay, he had a very short reign, right? He conquered the world in like about a decade, maybe a little bit more, and then died, and it broke up. So you've got one here, and then you've got two here. So this is the first beast, and this is the second beast. The second beast being the Medo-Persian Empire, or just the Persian Empire. Okay? And then what you've got from this point on to exactly what point you want to mark it depends. If you call it in the 60s BC, that would be when the Romans come in and conquer Jerusalem. You've got the Greeks. And then you've got the fourth kingdom would be the Romans. All right? So Daniel, in terms of time frame, at the very least, covers quite a bit of space here. When we get to the last chapter, it probably covers all of history. But at least here, these are your four beasts. You've got the first one, then you've got the Medo-Persians. This is the one where he has three bones in his mouth, three ribs in his mouth, probably representing the Persians conquering of Babylon, Lydia, not the person, the country, which was in Asia Minor, and Egypt. And then the Greeks, that's the leopard with four wings and four heads, all right, where the Greek, Alexander the Great, comes in, conquers, dies quickly, and then there's a lot of fighting, and ultimately you have four kingdoms that come out of that. Okay? Four kingdoms that come out of that. If you ever see the term, if you do reading, you will see the Diadochi. This refers to the four successors that ultimately made it through that. And then, of course, you have the great beast that's most fearsome that ultimately these guys couldn't stand up to. All right, all of them got wiped out by, in actual fact, all of them got taken over by the Romans. So that's what's going on there. So you've got beasts there representing, ultimately, not monsters, right, but nations, but kings, right, political forces within the world. Now if you look in 8, you've got in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, all right, and so this is him back still in the Babylonian period. This is Daniel there. A vision appeared to him, and I saw in the vision when, and this is verse 2, I was in Susa the citadel, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai canal. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him. And there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased, and his power was great. This would be the Medo-Persian Empire that's about to come. As I was considering, verse 5, behold, a male goat came from the west. Who's to the west of the Persian Empire? The Greeks, right? A male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, right? He's a hover goat. Now, the point of the hover goat, all right, is speed. He's going so fast, and this is what happened. He's going so fast, he's just unstoppable, all right? And so what does he do? The hover goat comes in, and there's a conspicuous horn between his eyes. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he read at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram, and he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. Why two horns for the ram? Medo-Persians, all right? And the ram had no power to stand before him. He cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, Alexander, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Okay? So you've got then the ram beaten by the goat. Okay? And the four horns. Now, in 824, let's read that real quick. This theme is going to be picked up in the last section, and at least more greatly developed. All right, in talking about these four kingdoms, his power shall be great. All right, but not by his own power. He shall cause fearful destruction, and shall succeed in what he does, and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. All right, so he's going to come in and destroy many, and this is when you first get essentially the abomination of desolation. Now, another thing we should put on there is essentially 164, which is going to be here-ish. Okay, 164 is when Antiochus Epiphanes, and we've talked about this guy. All right, Antiochus the IV Epiphanes. This is when he dies. Just a few years before he dies, the great story, we discussed it before. There's a lot of discussion between the king of the north and the king of the south in Daniel. This is a discussion about how the successor states to Alexander the Great, two of them, the Seleucids, who were based in Babylon in Asia Minor, were fighting with the Ptolemaic group, which is in Egypt. King of the north, the Seleucids. King of the south, the Ptolemies. Fighting back and forth. Antiochus, as a Seleucid, Antiochus Epiphanes, think Antioch. Where's Antioch? Oh, well, it's up in the north, if that helps. Antiochus Epiphanes, he goes down and he's about to whoop up on Egypt. But who shows up? Do you guys remember the story? Who shows up to tell him, you can't do this, and makes him turn around? You might remember this story? This is the one, it's really great. So Egypt in the ancient world was super important because it had lots of food. And because it had lots of food, it had lots of money because it could sell that food everywhere. There was a rising power in the West at this point. Rome. Not a hover goat. Previous story. All right. There's a rising power. And so what happens is, and this is recorded not only, it is actually in here, in Daniel, but it's actually in Roman sources as well. Antiochus is about to go in and conquer Egypt, and a Roman shows up and says, you need to turn around now. Because he did not want Seleucid to conquer Egypt. Antiochus. And Antiochus says, I'll take that under consideration. And then the Roman grabs a stick and draws a circle around Antiochus and says, you'll make a decision before you leave the circle, or you're at war with Rome. And Antiochus, the Seleucid king, he gives in, turns around. He's really angry because he's about to conquer Egypt. But the Romans have basically said, you're at war with us, and he can't risk that. So he turns around and he takes it out on the Jews. And so when he goes back up, he goes in, he ransacks the temple, he sacrifices a pig in the altar, defiling the temple, and that is the desolation of the temple. This kicks off very shortly, the Maccabean revolt, and so you've got also right around here is when the Maccabees come, and because of these things that Antiochus starts, they revolt, and they essentially get Jewish independence until the 60s, I think it's 64-ish, I don't remember the exact date, where not Ptolemy, Pompey. Okay, Pompey the Great comes in and conquers the Jews. Funny name, serious general. All right, so chapter 8 is about the ram and the goat, right? And then the goat breaking into four kingdoms and about the desolation. If you look in chapter 9, Daniel prays for his people. And if you want an Old Testament, succinct Old Testament story, or a succinct Old Testament theology of what we've talked about in terms of God making a covenant, God promising, if you disobey me, I will judge you, and ultimately that will lead you to exile. If you want a succinct statement of it, it's this chapter. That is exactly what Daniel prays. He goes through it, and he says, we made a covenant with you. We disobeyed. We're in exile. It's now time for that exile to be over. please God, free us. That's, go back and read that chapter, all right? All that stuff I go over all the time. It is exactly what Daniel prays right there. So it makes for a great succinct theological statement. And Gabriel brings an answer and talks about the 70 weeks. Now the 70 weeks, he basically talks about, okay, how long is it going to be until God ultimately solves all of these things? Where the number 70 comes from Daniel's belief that the exile would last 70 years. Okay? That the exiles, not since the destruction of Jerusalem, but since the first exiles, all right, it would be about 70 years, which is exactly how long it was until Cyrus the Great came in to free them. So Daniel's like, it's been about 70 years, God. When are you going to come and save us? And God says, well, it's not just going to be actually 70 years. It's going to be 70 times 7 years until it's all ultimately done. And so you've got there in verse 24, 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity. And it talks in here about, if you look, for example, at verse 26, and after 62 weeks, this isn't 62 weeks, this is really more like 400 years. An anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end shall come with a flood. And the end shall be, there shall be a war, desolations are decreed. All right? So this is talking, who's the prince who's cut off of the people? This is actually talking about Jesus. And so Daniel's praying about near term, and God does deliver them near term. But ultimately for it to be ended, it's going to be a long time. And then finally, you've got in chapter 10, and this is in the third year of Cyrus the king of Persia. So this is definitely Daniel in the Persian period. You've got a section here with chapter 10 is fairly tame as far as chapters go in terms of material. It's Daniel visited by angelic beings, and he is very much intimidated, as you would expect. Chapter 11, I have subtitled The Kings of the North and the Kings of the South. In chapter 11, he goes through this long discussion. All right, if you read it, about, and this king will go down here and he'll conquer that, and that king will come up, go from there to come up here and he'll conquer this, and so forth, and somewhat all that. What that's talking about is this struggle in here between the Ptolemaic and the Seleucid empires. When you had your four kingdoms break up, you've only got two that are actually very relevant for the Jews at all. There's the Seleucids, which most often held Palestine. They were obviously very relevant. And you've got the Ptolemies, which sometimes held Palestine and Judah at that point. They're obviously relevant. Then you've got Lysimachus up in Thrace, which is not relevant. That's too far away. And you've got Cassander and his group after him in Macedonian Greece, not relevant, too far away. And so this is all about the kings of the north, the Seleucids versus the Ptolemies within this time period. And that's when if we go to look at 1136, this is about Antiochus Epiphanes. Generally, everybody agrees that this is about Antiochus Epiphanes. And the king, generally everybody, who knows if everybody does, but. And the king shall do as he wills. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, and shall speak astonishing things against the God of gods. He shall prosper till the indignation is accomplished, for what is decreed shall be done. All right? Epiphanes, he is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes in the sense of God manifest. All right? Yeah, I'm your king, but I'm also the manifestation of God to you. That was what he called himself. And so this is about him. And this is about the fight there, but also you get the abomination of desolation. You get him in the temple. And then you've got this last section, all right, which starts in chapter 11, which goes into chapter 12. It's talking about the end, all right? talking about the end, starting in verse 40. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall rush upon him like a whirlwind. And in chapter 12, verse 1, in that time shall arise Michael, the great prince, who has charge of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble. All right, and so this continues. And so what you've got here in terms of the end, all right, is he's talking about something later than the abomination of desolation. What it sounds like in this paragraph is that the king of the north, whoever he is, will conquer Egypt. The Seleucids never conquered Egypt. All right, they never did that historically, never happened. The Romans later conquered Egypt, but Seleucids were defeated by the Romans before this. And so one way to possibly look at this, and this is somewhat confusing, so something to think about. One way to possibly look at this would be to look at this as this is something even further in the future. As Daniel, at this point, is already looking several hundred years in his vision into the future. All right? Daniel's dead way back here. He could live a long time, but he didn't live that long, right? So he's looking several hundred years into the future. And as it goes on and on, perhaps it's getting a little foggier for him. And we've in Revelation, we've come here before to talk about the vision of the guy hovering over the waters. Remember that? Raising his hand and swearing? That's all in here. And so that's essentially Daniel. The first six chapters are visions of kings and other things about living in a foreign land. The theme of what it's like to live in the foreign land is not a big subject matter at all when you get to 7. At that point, it's various visions covering various empires, all right? Babylon, Persians, the Greeks, and ultimately the Romans. And those visions of the beast, all right, those visions of the beast are super important, because if you read that wrong and go, oh, physical beast coming out of the sea, you're entirely missing the point. Turn to chapter 10. This is a notion we've talked about a lot. Daniel talked about it very explicitly. If we look in chapter 10, verse 12, if we see, like, then he said to me, fear not, Daniel, from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled yourself before your God, your words have been heard. And I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I was left there with the kings of Persia. And came to make you understand what is to happen in the, to your people in the latter days. For the vision is for days yet to come. So are we saying that there was an angel that was trying to fight the king of Persia, and he couldn't do it until another angel came to help him? That's not the story. The story is these are spiritual beings behind the kingdoms, either behind God or behind the Persian kingdom, and they're fighting. And so the picture of these wars, all right, this is not just secular history happening. The rise of Babylon, the fall of Babylon, the rise of Persia, their fall, the rise of Alexander and his, and their fall, and the rise of Roman. None of that is secular history from this perspective. It's all ordained by God. All right, and behind them stand beings. All right, stand angels or demons. Or if you look in verse 20, then he said, do you know why I've come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. All right. Prince of Greece. What do you mean the prince of Greece is coming? Is this talking about Alexander? I mean, sort of. It's talking about the spiritual reality behind Alexander. And so all of these beasts and all these are nations, these are kings, these are political powers. Don't look at it as a secular person. Look at it from a Danielic sense. When you look at the beasts, you don't actually have to have a physical beast for this. Okay? You've got nations. So there's an overview of Daniel. We are out of time. So what I want you to do is think about this and go back and focus just on your own study. Go back and read through. All right, you could start really with 7. All right, read 7 through 12. Think about the beasts. Think about their functions. You'll see these basic ideas. Hopefully this outline will help. I've put at the top there a number of dates for you. Okay? Because Daniel's covering this whole big area. And when Daniel talks about the end, at the end of chapter 11 and in chapter 12, this is stuff that potentially spills into not only the Roman period, but also AD 70, also post AD 70, Revelation chapter 20, 21. So think about those things before we go back to Revelation. All right? Now, next week, I will not be here. And so you've got 2 full weeks to ingest and think about Daniel and his beasts. All right? Any questions or... I've just been talking a whole lot today. Kind of trying to blaze through it like a hover goat. Go through the material.
Does it ride a hoverboard or does it just float?
It's just too fast. It jumps. All right? Okay. Let's dismiss then. Grady, will you pray for us, please?